Okay, Parsha Shmos, Tav Shin Ayin Aleph. We're working today with three words, and those three words are the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as it appears in Perek Gimel. When Moshe asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu to kind of explain to him, to clarify to him, which name he should tell Bnei Yisrael he is coming to represent. So this is at the story of the Sneh, remember? And there's a burning fire inside, a dried out thorn bush or some type of lowly bush. And Moshe recognizes it as a vision, a mystical vision. He sees it's not, you know, it's something extraordinary. And of course, Hashem speaks to him through this vision. And he tells him to go to take Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. And we've spoken about different aspects of this in the past. Today we're going to focus on Moshe's question to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It says, V'yomer Moshe el ha'elokim, Hine anochi ba el Bnei Yisrael, I will come to the Jewish people, V'yamarti lahem, and I will say to them, Elokai, Elokei avoseichem shalachani elechem, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they're going to say to me, Mashmo, what's his name? Now, what is that? They're testing me. They're trying to trap me. Everybody knows Hashem's name. If it's the God of the fathers, we know Hashem appeared to the fathers and introduced himself many times with the name Shakai, and Anikel, right? Kel Shakai. I mean, what's his name? What was this? And Moshe says, what should I tell them? Ma Omar Alehem. What should I say to them? So, you know, simply, why are they asking this question? What's his name? And why is Moshe, what is Moshe getting at when he says, and how should I answer them? So, Vayomer Elokim El Moshe, Elokim said to Moshe, Eheke Asher Eheke. You're not allowed to pronounce this. This name, as we'll see in a moment, is the name of a Kadosh Baruch Hu that can't be written straight and cannot be pronounced straight. Simply, it means the Aleph in front is always future and it's always first person. I will be that which I will be. That's the name of Hashem. Vayomer, and he says, go tell, ko tomar l'bnei Yisrael, go tell Bnei Yisrael, say to them, Eke shalachani eilechem. The name, the God that is sending me is known through the name Eke. I will be. So first of all, a few things. What is Moshe's objective here, okay? And when we start to analyze Moshe's objective to see what he wants to know about, you know, what name should I say, you're sending me, you know, with, he's really going, asking Kadosh Baruch Hu about his mission. Who is he representing? What message is he bringing to them? And our job here is to really come to some understanding that if this is the way Hashem describes himself, then this is really what Moshe has to convey to the people. In other words, all their questions are going to be answered really with this idea, the name of God that Moshe is speaking in. In other words, why are they in Gullus? And how will they come out of Gullus? And why do they have to endure all of this in Gullus? And what's the purpose of Gullus? That's really all implied in what should I tell them your name is. So what we're working with here is, and what we're going to be looking into really is, the essence, you know, the at the core, why is Gullus such a necessity that Hashem put them in there, that now Hashem is taking them out of there? Remember that Gullus was predicted, predetermined, before there was ever even Yitzchak, before there was a chance for anybody to sin, Gullus was already predetermined. Gullus is part of the cycle. What's its purpose? So here, Ramban, we'll start with Ramban. And, let me start with something else, actually. The name Eke. Okay, the name Eke, the Rashbam explains, is really a different construct of the word, of the name Yud Ke Vav Ke. Except we substitute at the beginning of the word an Aleph for a Yud. When we describe Hashem, as we talk, and any time in grammar we talk in the third person, we put a Yud in front of it. You say, I will go, ani elech, he hu yelech, he will go, right? I is the Aleph, and he, third person, is the Yud. So Yud Ke Vav Ke, he is what he is the same as Hashem saying, Eheke, I am what I am. We substitute the Aleph for the Yud, and then we switch the in Eheke, there's a Yud, and in Yud Ke Vav Ke, there's a Vav. And there's a that is a whole talk in and of itself. But the Rashbam points out this is the same word, same name of Hashem, Yud Ke Vav Ke in Eheke Asher Eheke. And therefore, it's one of it's the name that we don't write and we don't pronounce. And it's the name of the Bria, and it's the name that HaKadosh Baruch Hu introduces himself with at ultimately Har Sinai. Anochi Hashem, Yudke Vavke, Elokecha, your God. So this is the name that he's coming to Klal Yisrael with, but it's specifically formulated in I will be that which I will be. Now, Ramban brings down numerous approaches to this question, this answer, and the name itself, and he brings his own opinion among them after criticizing or not accepting, rather, for example, Evan Ezra's opinion. He says that this is his opinion. He says, Lefi Dati, according to my opinion, Haya Moshe Gam Be'esahi Av B'Chachma. At that time already, Moshe was a father, a real force in Chachma, a master of wisdom. Godol B'Mala Sanavua, already great in the attainment of prophecy. V'derach She'ele, and it was by way of inquiry, Bike, she asked the Kodesh Baruch Hu, Shoyidiehu Mi Hashalecha, so he should inform him who is sending him. Kolomar, in other words, what he's saying is this. Be'eze mida, with what of God's attributes is he being sent? In other words, what of God's midos are going to be revealed here? He's asking about the mida of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that will be revealed through the Geula. When we say mida, we don't mean, and we've talked about this, the Rambam stresses this in the Mor Nevuchim, not the essence or nature of God himself, but what will be understood by us in this world about how God conducts the world. A midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is really an aspect of how Hashem conducts the world. A midah is something we can grasp, get a certain hold on, recognize to be the way Hashem is interacting with the world. It doesn't say a thing about the essence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem's nature, so to speak, but what humanity will come to know about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's called a midah, okay? A measure. And we'll talk about midahs again. Midah is a measure, a quantity. Something that can be understood and, you know, described, defined within a particular, you know, within particular contours. So Moshe is saying, what will come to be known about you through this revelation of this Exodus and everything that's about to happen? What's the main message? Now, there are many, many approaches. Ramban brings down many approaches. But we're going to focus on an approach which is more, you know, really gets to the mystical core of it. Just some of the approaches of that Ramban brings down are like Rashi says, first of all, I will be with them in this tzara like I will be with them in every other tzara, right? That the mida is that I'm with them in tzaras. That I'm compassionate, that I'm together with them. Now, we spoke a lot about this in the past, that this is the most significant thing they have to know about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The midah of Hashem is with us in Golas, and we spoke about the Beis HaLevi. When Yaakov is going down to Golas, Hashem says to him, don't be afraid. Anochi Ered Imach, I'm going to go down with you. V'anochi Elcha, and I will bring you up, Gam Alo. And the Beis HaLevi says, I will bring you up, and thereby I also will come out of Golas. Because as long as Klal Yisrael are in Golas, the name of Hashem is not known. Because Hashem's name is only known through the survival and the salvations and the Yeshuas of Klal Yisrael. That is how Hashem's name is known in this world. And Hashem has linked his name to our name, which is what we say in the Bracha in Shmona Esrei. Mevi goel libnei b'nehem leman shemo. On account of his own name, he brings redemption to the grandchildren. Right? We spoke about this last year when we talked about, I don't know if you remember, an idea that the names of Klal Yisrael, which represent redemption, went into Golas. Eile shemos, the names went into Golas. We did a whole thing about that. But the fact is that Rav Yonasan Eibshitz writes that of all the miracles that Hashem did in Mitzrayim and in the Midbar and on the Yam, the greatest miracle of all the miracles, the thing that is most astonishing, that moves him the most, is that this that Hashem promised out of love, that he will link his name to the name of Klal Yisrael and will only be known through the Yeshuas of Klal Yisrael. through the salvation of Klal Yisrael, through the survival and the and what we spoke about in terms of Hanukkah, the Mesiras Nefesh, and the truth that emerges from Klal Yisrael's existence and continued existence. So one thing Rashi says is the main midah is Hashem is with us in Golus. Therefore, we're never alone and we're guaranteed a Geula. That's one thing. That's Rashi. There's also Eke Asher Eke means that I will mirror their behavior. I will be what they will be. So if they're honest, I'll be honest with them, and if they're compassionate, I'll be compassionate with them. There's another that Ekesh or Ekem means I'm Hayahove V'yiyam, transcend time. Rambam says that only I exist, and it's the source of absolute existence. He goes through many different explanations of Ekesh or Ekem. We're going to focus on something of Moshe Shapiro brings down, that the Zohar brings down, and that is simply that Ekeh is Bigamatria 21. Asher Ekeh, that I will be, is another 21. Now, another time we spoke about, and this is not our talk today, 21 plus 21 is 42. And what is that? How significant is that number? 42 masos, 42 stations in their travels from Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael. The Golos is described in 42 degrees or stations also, or parts of the journey. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with us through all those 42 stations along the way. But here we're going in a different direction. 21 times 21. When you times a number by itself, it means that every component of that number can expand to be the complete number. Every element of it expands and grows and seems to contain the whole number itself. 21 times 21 is 441. That is the gematria. Let's figure it out. What's 1? Aleph. 40 mem. Tav, 400. 441 is emes. What we're saying here is that Moshe is saying, which midah are you, am I speaking on behalf of? What will be revealed through this Yemetzias Mitzrayim? The midah of emes. Now, that sounds very nice. What does that mean? The midah of emes will be revealed through Yetzias Mitzrayim, which means to say that in order to reveal emes in the world, they had to go down to Mitzrayim to begin with. That the reason for the Golos, the reason they had to endure all of this, and the reason Hashem stays with them, as Rashi says, Imo Anochi Betzara, and is with them in Golos, is because the whole point of the Golos, and the end of the Golos, and the salvation from the Golos, is to bring about emes in the world. So now we have a strange idea. That emes is the end result of a lot of sheker. Right? Isn't the Golos a sheker? Isn't our every Golos a sheker? We're the Jewish people who've contributed the most on earth to society in this world, who've any decent good thing basically that came to this world have confined its source in our belief system and our people. That we who are the source of emes, live for emes and die for emes, that we are the most vilified, the most treated the most unjustly, the most accused of things that we're not guilty of, etc. So the fact is that emes, in order to express emes, to reveal emes, it has to go into Golos. It has to be completely, squelched. And then through the great, Yeshua and the great Yetziah and the great Nisim and Niflaos that come from Hashem's salvation, then emes will be revealed. That's really what's happening. That if I will be what I will be, which means I will be pure emes in its complete form via the Golos. Okay, so now we get to something here which has a precedent. The precedent is that emes comes from darkness. It comes from the lack of emes. So here's a famous piece describing the condition, the predicament of emes. Okay, in Bereishis Rabbah, it says like this, Amar Rav Simon, that B'sha'ah, the Simon is Simon, by the way, B'sha'ah Shabbah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Levros Es HaAdam, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to create man, Adam HaRishon, all the Malachi HaShareis formed little groups and presented their arguments, okay? And these are some of the arguments. Chesed said, create man, shehu gomel chasadim, because he's a very kind and compassionate. Emes came and said, al yivra, don't create man, shekulo shkarim, is all lies. Tzedek amma omer, so tzedek, righteousness, came and said, create man, because shehu oset tzedakos, he does a lot of righteousness and good things. And then Sholem came and said, Al Yivra, don't create man, to Kule Katata. He's all quarrelsome and full of dissension, contention. Don't create them. Ma Asa, so what happened? HaKadosh Baruch Hu Natal Emes, he took Emes, truth, Vishlicho La'aretz, and he threw it down to the earth. And this is what it means, Vatishlach Emes Artsa, he threw down Emes to the ground. Amru Malach Yasharis, the angel said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what are you doing? Why do you dishonor your own seal, your own insignia? You are known by Emes. Why are you casting it to the ground? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu answered, and this is in Tehillim, Pei Hei 85 Yud Beis, Emes me Eretz Titzmach. Emes will grow from the ground up, will not emanate from heaven. Now, we've spoken about this, right? With Hanukkah, right? With the first Kufa of Jewish history, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks on our behalf, and which is another way of saying Emes originates in heaven. And then the whole rest of history, which is over 2,000 years, including the second Beis HaMikdash era, so 2,500 years or more, where Emes comes from us. We are the source of Emes. Let's look at it from a whole other perspective. The same perspective, but a different angle to it. The fact that Emes, truth, originates, sprouts from the ground. It starts, it's grassroots. It doesn't start in heaven. Well, anything that sprouts from the ground, how does that work? How does a tree which sprouts from the ground start to grow? So the way, this is very strange, right, and counterintuitive. You take a little seed, right, and you put it under the dirt where it's cold, and it gets no sunlight, and everybody walks on it, and then it disintegrates, and it starts to rot. And then what happens? And then it starts to sprout, and what comes from it could be an enormous, you know, an oak tree or something, you know, a billion times larger than the seed itself. So the concept of sprouting implies that it must disintegrate, it must degenerate, it must look like it's dead, and then it begins to actually show that it's really alive. That's the miracle of how things grow. Now, so when it talks about MS, also slowly emerging, it's of that same sort. At first, it's put into a situation where it's virtually unseen. It has no effect. Nobody knows what's happening. And there, beneath the surface, it's beginning to germinate, and it's beginning to set down roots, and then it begins to slowly emerge. That's how MS operates. So what that means is that it has to be put, there has to be something called a gullus. There has to be a dark, you know, miserable situation. And what happens in that gullus? In that gullus, all other excuses or attempts for MS are presented or tried. And then what happens? All of that sheker has its day, expresses itself, puts all its effort into, you know, creating the world over in its, according to its vision. And beneath all of it, MS is sprouting, and all of that is not, all those things that are not MS might be above the surface, and beneath the surface, there's something going on, and it's barely seen. Now, when we talk about MS versus Sheker, and Sheker's MS being sprouting under the ground, and Sheker, you know, being revealed, okay? We always search for, we look for truth. Truth has to be, you know, you have to dig for the truth. But let's talk about how you find truth for a while, for a moment. What is the most effective way to come to the truth? So, for example, when you work in medicine, which I, by the way, in my previous life, I was an ultrasound tech. And when you work in medicine and you're trying to find out what is going on with someone who has symptoms and you're not sure because many, many, many different things can cause these symptoms, you get a little note from the doctor and it says, rule out. Okay, what are the things that it's not? Rule out the following things. When you rule out the possible reasons for the pathology or for the illness or for the symptoms, then you can begin to focus on what it might be. That's how it works in scientific method also. Scientific method is not so much about coming up with a hypothesis and proving that it's true. Part and parcel, the bulk of the work is proving or showing that all other things are not true. It could be that in a certain case something behaves in a certain way, but if you don't prove that in every other case it doesn't, you really haven't come to any knowledge and any wisdom. A lot of science is proving things that don't work, discounting things. It's called the process of elimination. That is a way to come to know what is true, is not so much to just take an idea that we imagine to be true and explain it and describe it, but take all things that claim to be true, that might claim to yield the same end, and by process of elimination show they don't get to where we want to get to, and only this one does. So really what we're talking about is that truth has to wait. Truth is the end result of everything else being eliminated. So for example here, when the Reish Lakish died, here's how Chazal described it. When Reish Lakish died, Rav Yochanan, this is in Bava Metzia, Rav Yochanan said he would mourn anew every time he would give a discourse when Reish Lakish passed away. He would weep and he would say, "Where is Bar Lakisha? Where is Bar Lakisha?" His remaining disciples attempted to console him. They said, "Why do you miss him so much? We're here. We bring numerous proofs to you and all your insights." He says, "That is exactly why I weep, because I do not require your proofs. I require Reish Lakish's endless attempts at disproving what I was trying to say, so that in the end, I knew and I could, you know, and I honed in my ideas or my, you know, what I was trying to prove, and knew that they were really true." Because he challenged me with every possible disproof, and that's what I miss. So what we're trying to say here is that the way Chazal see truth and wisdom is it's the end result of nothing else standing up to the light of scrutiny, and only this thing standing up. In other words, we say it, you know, in our slang, that when you're faced with a possible, you know, course of action, you basically eliminate all other, you know, choices that you might have taken when you were younger or you didn't have as much experience. I've been there, done that. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. So it leaves me with one option. Okay? Truth has to wait. Here's an example that my grandfather brings down in the end of Parshas Tazria. And we mentioned this in the context to a few things. Actually, we talked about it a little bit with Shechem and Dina, but this is a different way of looking at it. When a person has saras, the strange and kind of like counterintuitive reality about saras is when the entire flesh is covered in saras and the person's skin is dead from top to bottom and there's not one healthy cell and it's all white, then the person is tahar. That's when the person is no longer has saras and they're tahar. They're pure. So here's what Sanhedrin says. Amar Rav Yitzchak. Here, let me read the pasuk. It's in Parshas Tazria, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Ure'ei Kohen, the Kohen looks at it and he sees, Vihine, Kisasa Tsaras, as Kol Besar, this Tsaras has completely covered all of his flesh. V'tahar Esanega, and now he declares it Tahar, it's completely pure. Kulo Hafach Lavan Taharu, it's all turned completely white, it's Tahar. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Amar Rav Yitzchak, Ein Ben David Ba, the son of David, who's always, of course, Mashiach, but he's always associated with David, and we'll get to David soon. Until every single government is revealed to be apostasy, a lie, incapable of really bringing truth or good, you know, ultimately goodness to the world. And that's what it means. When everything turns white, the person is tahar. When all of the governments, when everything we had hope in, when all other possible political systems, when any idea that was presented to help humanity, to bring about utopia, when all of them have risen, you know, filled the world, as Mark Twain says, with a lot of, you know, noise and glory, and then have imploded and have died out because they don't provide the solutions they were trying to provide, and they're not seen anymore as solutions or as viable options. They've all played themselves out. Until every single possible way of existing in this world, every government and every idea and every structure, national structure, has, you know, has played itself out, then when there's no options left, then David comes. Truth has to wait. By through the process of elimination, everything else repudiates itself. This is the concept. The greatest form of MS is not when MS declares that it's MS, but when Sheker declares that it's Sheker. That's the ultimate MS. By the way, the example of this is Purim, which is a glimpse at Acharis Hayomim. Purim, although it happened at the end of the Churban Bais Rishon, and it happened before Hanukkah, is really a light, a glimpse at the light at the end of the historic tunnel. Because the story of Purim is not Emes coming from heaven, like in Mitzrayim, with big miracles. It's Emes coming from right here, where evil and all the effort and all the creativity and all the shenanigans and the maneuverings of Haman come back like a boomerang to destroy himself first and pretty much only, and actually promote the people he was trying to destroy. So that Sheker stands up and says, I've destroyed myself. He was the one who thought of the gallows that he hung on. He was the one that put Esther on the throne. All his wealth went to Mordechai. He sent the Jews back to Eretz Yisrael. Really? Because Esther was on the throne and Daryavish was her either biological or ideological child. And he sent Klal Yisrael, he let Klal Yisrael back to go to Eretz Yisrael. That was everything he tried to undermine. He thought that he would disgrace Mordechai, but he was the one pulling Mordechai around on the horse. In other words, all of his sheker came back to destroy him and his family. So that sheker itself says, I've destroyed myself. Sheker repudiates itself. That's the greatest form of MS. MS has to grow. It has to be unseen. And then when the conditions are right, after a long time, and everything else is dead, then in all its full glory, MS starts to show itself. But it has to go through a phase. That's the concept of titzmach, where it's not revealed and it's not obvious and it doesn't have the force to compel anything. It's just hell, it's just there under the ground. Now that existence under the ground in a dark place, right? Watered with a little water, where is that? Where do you find that MS? So my grandfather said poetically, very beautifully, the MS lived in the hearts of the Jewish people, in our little societies, in our little communities, and how we lived. And how we conducted ourselves. There was MS and our views. And sometimes when those views became contradictory, clearly contradictory to the views of the countries that we lived amongst, you know, there was an assault against us. Hitler, as you know, said, the Jews are the conscience of mankind. We live differently. The Romans couldn't understand when they were in Eretz Yisrael. They said, this people makes no sense. They free their slaves. They believe in human rights. It makes no sense. They couldn't take it. They could not abide by our principles, by our truths. And yet we hold on to them. And the tears, my grandfather says, that every honest good Jew cried over the injustice, over the gullus, over the chilul Hashem of emes being trampled under the ground as it affected every individual Jew, as the reputation of the nation as a whole, the way we were perceived in the world. He said those tears, those were the tears that watered that little seed that was waiting under the ground to sprout. The tears of all the good, honest Jews through the ages. That's what allows the MS to eventually reveal itself in a world that's all sheker. And I once heard somebody say, back in the days of the struggle for Soviet Jewry, remember the student struggle? And my grandfather said this too at an Agudah convention. He said it in a different way. He said, I think my grandfather said this, but it was in those days. It was at an Agudah convention. And it was early in the times like of Elio Esses, you know, in the first few beginning, you know, Balei Tshuva that were being found among the Russians. And he says, if a body is dead and everybody considers it to be dead, Judaism was thought to be dead, it doesn't have to burst out of the ground singing and dancing. All that has to happen is it has to just move one pinky, and it's enough to send shock waves. A corpse under the ground starts to move one little pinky one or two times. That's enough to know that it's not dead and it's alive, and that's what's happening. And he said also, the pure devotion to Emes of those early refuseniks who decided to study Torah and to get a few pages, photographs of Sidurim and sacrifice and be with the threat of Siberia and Russian dungeons and all that stuff. He said that pure pursuit of Emes is the force that brought down the entire sheker of the whole Russian communist system. That's what brought it down. The MS that was alive in it and could not be squelched, that was kept alive, that brought down the sheker in the end. And then when the sheker repudiates itself, implodes in and of itself, and you see it doesn't work, and it's not, it doesn't make, and it isn't the dream that it claimed to be, then the emes, which is latent, that has been waiting around, starts to reveal itself. Now, we have a bracha in Shmona Esrei, Es Tzemach David Avdecha Mehera Tatzmiach, and we're going to talk about David for a while, because David is the great-grandfather of Mashiach, which is going to bring the emes that lives in everybody's hearts, that we cry for, to it's going to allow it to sprout, to really reveal itself. Okay? So David himself in his own life must undergo a situation where the emes is so, again, kind of like trampled upon, so overshadowed, so lost in the sheker, that it has to, in his own life, he has to experience and become a role model for the ability to face the sheker, call it sheker, and let the MS emerge. Now, the big, big black spot, the big area where David deluded himself and ended up in a web of lies and sheker, one leading to the next, was the David and Bathsheba incident. But let's look at it carefully, because it's prone to so many misconceptions, but that is where he calls sheker sheker, he says chatasi, and that's where he emerges to the greatness of who he was. And we all read his Tehillim, and his tshuva is the greatest form of tshuva on earth. So what happened there? Chazal want us, first of all, to process of elimination, try to figure out what happened there. Okay, we're talking about David HaMelech, and one of the ways we figure out what happened there is by analyzing what Nasan HaNavi said to him. So first, let's talk about Nasan HaNavi's example, and then we'll go back and see what David's guilty of or not guilty of. So Nasan HaNavi comes in Perek Beis and Shmuel Beis and says to him, says like this, I have a dilemma. I don't know what to do. And he speaks about it in a way that David does not relate it to himself at all, and it's a year later, and he can be completely objective here. And by the way, be very, very careful. When HaKadosh, we have a rule, b'derech she'adam moded, the way a person judges or kind of evaluates a situation, that's the way they are evaluated, because the way a person evaluates a situation means how they see it when they're objective, when they're clear, when their rational faculties are working well, and they're not completely clouded over by subjective, perceptions, and they're not completely, they haven't descended into a web of delusion because of their own temptations and personal subjective interests. How a person calls something and evaluates something and judges something in a moment of objectivity is what is the standard the person is held to. And then how they act contrary to that, how big that gap is, that's the sin. How what they know to be true and how far they let themselves digress from that, that gap, that space is the sin. The action is just the natural result of that gap. Okay, whatever action takes place is a result of that disconnect. So be very careful. Sometimes when we're called into a situation that we are asked or we have an opportunity to make a declaration about what's right and wrong, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could be presenting us with that opportunity to sentence ourselves. B'derech she'adam moded, kach moded imoso. The way a person declares, judges, that's exactly how Hashem will judge that person. So that's what happens right here, as you'll see, with Nasan HaNavi and David. So he gives him a hypothetical. Let's David really proclaim his own sentence. So he says, there was a rich man and a poor man in a city. And the rich man had a lot of flocks and a lot of herds. And the poor person had one little lamb that he treasured and he loved and he grew up with him. And he would eat its bread and drink from its cup and slept in his bosom, and it was like a daughter. So, 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 so precious to this person was this one little lamb, okay? Vayavo, now be very careful here. Vayavo holich. First he calls him a holich. He refers to this person three different ways. First time he's a holich. And a holich, a passerby, coming through, no connections, comes to the rich man. Vayachmol, very important word. Vayachmol, he had chemla, he had a form of compassion. What is chemla? It's a very particular form of compassion. Like we say, Ava Rabba Avtanu, right? Chemla, Gedola, Vayetera, Chamalta. What is chemla? Chemla, my grandfather explains in Tefillah, means when you should act b'midas hadin, and instead you act b'midas harachamim. So when we say about a Kaddish Baruch Hu, really we deserve din, but you go ahead and disregard it and you give us rachamim, that's called chemla. But when you do it to yourself, that's a huge crime. When you should conduct, you know, evaluate your choice of action by the letter of what's right and wrong, and instead you're very generous with yourself and cross many, many lines and treat yourself very kindly. And here it says, Vayachmol, this rich man had chemla on himself, and he didn't want to take his own sheep to feed this passerby, take his own lamb. So it says, Vayachmol, he had all this chemla. He did not act correctly, according to justice. And he didn't want to take mitzono, mibukaro, from his own herd. Lasos, to make something, la'oreach. All of a sudden, this person's an oreach, a guest with a suitcase who's here for a while. Okay? Vayikachas kivsas ha'ish harashi. He went and took the little lamb of the poor person, vayasen, he made it la'ish haba elav, to the person that came to him. And now this is a person. A holich is a passerby. An oreach is someone who's setting down his stuff for a few days. He's here. You gotta contend with it. And an ish haboilav is a person with opinions and a dominant, you know, force. Who's someone you have to contend with. Someone who's here to stay. He's not a passerby. He's not a guest. He's like you. He's right here. So this person is clearly this person who came by and I don't want to take my sheep. Let me take his sheep. This person who came by is really provides a challenge. And the challenge and the way this challenge is presented as something that gets something or a temptation really, something that first, you can make a connection or not, but you let it settle in and then you let it settle in deeper and then you kind of cater to it, and the more you cater to it and the more you give into it and the more you accommodate it, it's here to stay. And when it comes here to stay, you go ahead and take the poor man's lamb and you don't care and you prepare it for this person who's here to stay. In other words, your whole judgment is clouded because living with you now is something that causes you to act contrary to what you know is right. Okay, so what's living with you? What's living with you is a temptation that led you to rationalize all your behavior. Vayichar af David ba'ishma'od. David became exceedingly angry at this hypothetical person. And he says, Vayomer al Nasan. He declares a sentence here. Chai Hashem, by the life of God. In other words, by truth, by absolute standards. Ki ben maves ha'ish ha'osezos. This person should die. Now, you don't die for stealing, right? So what's David so angry about? It's not the theft. The theft is the end result of allowing himself to become so subjective by not wanting to give up something that he had, or indulging himself, that he allowed himself to do this, and that's what the crime was. The crime was, as David now expresses more clearly, he says he should pay back four times. Ekev asher asas adavar hazeh, because he did this terrible thing, which now he explains, al asher lo chamal. He didn't have any chemla on who? On who didn't he have any chemla? On the poor person. He had no sense of compassion for the poor person. He had compassion on himself, and he didn't have compassion on the weak person that he took advantage of, and that's why he should die, and he should be repaid four times for his evil. So what David's angry about is lack of compassion for the poor man, which came from too much compassion on himself, too much self-indulgence, which clouded his vision and made him cruel. So that's what's really happening. Something clouded David's vision, and the sin here, be very careful, is cruelty to an innocent person. That's the sin. Now, who's the innocent person that David was cruel to? Uriah. Okay, now, let's talk about that. It's not so simple. That's why David didn't recognize his sin, because it wasn't so posh that Uriah was an innocent person. Okay, so now, first of all, unfortunately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did exactly what David said. He paid him back four times in four disasters. First of all, this baby died. He had the disaster of Amnon, Tamar, and of Shalom. And then, more than that, Nasan HaNavi told him, you are the man, Ata Ish, Ko Amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, I am going to destroy you from being king on Yisrael. And he says, I'm sorry, I'm reading this wrong. Ani mashachticha, I've anointed you to be king in Israel. However, I'm going to take, eventually he says, I'm going to take away your malchus. It's going to be divided between, you know, after Shlomo. And he says, you did this, and you disgraced the Kadosh Baruch Hu by doing this terrible thing. Madua bazisa estvar Hashem. Why did you disgrace the word of Hashem? Lasos hara be'enav, to do bad in Hashem's eyes. Es uriah hachiti hikisa b'cherev. This is the crime that Nathan tells him. You killed Uriah by the sword. And you took his wife as your wife. But also, and this is the real thing, also haragta b'cherev b'nei Amon. That's David's sin, and we forget to mention that. You killed him by b'nei Amon. Now, let's analyze this. So Gemara says, did he do shvichas damim? Gemara says, did he do gilui arayos? The Gemara says, no. He was not guilty of adultery because technically she was divorced. Okay, they used to give their give a get krisos, a contingent get when they would go to war, that they, retroactively she would be divorced if they would not come back. Okay, if they would come back, then she's married. By the way, some of them used to remarry when they would come back because the conditions of this divorce were very, you know, it was like a real divorce. Now, Uriah had given her this divorce. And David saw her, and he had Ruach HaKodesh, or he knew that they were destined to be together and that their child would be Shlomo. Don't forget, by the way, Mashiach always comes with these very, very kind of, convoluted ways. He gets the news. It's not Gilui Arayos. Technically, it's not adultery. He gets the news that she's pregnant. This is all in the Navi. Now he's faced with a huge dilemma. It's going to be clear that she's pregnant and her husband's not home. Something happened. So instead of her looking like a harlot, he has to make a decision. Now he's stuck. One mistake leads to the next. What was his mistake? His first mistake is he didn't wait. He waited many years to become a melech, even though Hashem anointed him through Shmuel Hanavi. And yet when Shaul tried to kill him, he never did anything. He never tried to kill Shaul. He waited patiently. But here he didn't wait. He was impulsive with this temptation. So he didn't wait here. There's a lot of background to this, by the way. There's a lot of background to this because he had asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, well, how do you merit to get your name attached to Hashem's name? Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Hashem said, you have to be tested. He said, test me. Hashem said, you're going to regret this, but okay. So then immediately the Bat Sheva incident happened. Okay. So it's not Gilui Arayos, but now he's got a problem. She's going to look like a harlot. And she's going to look like Uriah's not home. What does he do? He calls Uriah back from the battlefield, which really what he does is he's willing now, if Uriah comes back and is officially returns, then she might have not been divorced, which means he is now guilty of Gilui Arayos. He's willing to take upon himself the sin, retroactively, of him doing adultery, so that the story shouldn't come out, and it shouldn't be a Chil Hashem. But one bad thing leads to the next. We create a whole web. Lies lead to a web of lies. So Uriah now says no. Now Uriah himself was a problem. And Chazal say that they were already not really married, more than officially. And they were, she even when she mourns him, she mourns him as her Baal, but not as her Isha, not as her husband. So that now they were a very separate minds. Why? We're taught the background. She was a supporter of David. And he was actually a supporter and a possible, fermenting a rebellion against David by supporting Yoav, David's chief of staff. So he says like this, David calls him back and he says, go home, take a little vacation, you deserve a break, go back, sleep with your wife. Now, next problem. Now this child's going to, if he does, then it looks like a mamzer. It is a mamzer, and the child, David is creating a mamzer, and nobody will know, but David knows, Bathsheba knows. One bad thing leads to the next. But Uriah says, you know what? No. Uriah doesn't like David at all anyway. And by the way, the parasha starts out that part of this whole thing happened is also chemla, too much compassion on himself, because it says that everybody was at war. Vayishlach David es Yoav. David sent out Yoav. Vyes Avadav. And all of his servants, his personal guard. Emo, to go with you, let's call Yisrael, and all of Yisrael, which means it was a big war, he had to call out, it was a draft, everybody had to go, and they had to fight B'nai Amon, it was a serious war, But who, David Yoshev B'Yerushalayim? That's the first condemnation. What was he doing in Yerushalayim? In his palace, when his whole country was in the war. He should have been out there. A little bit, you know, he was the king. He took a liberty. And then he sees her and the whole rights. He calls back Yoav, so he calls back Uriah. And Uriah says, David says, go home. But Yavo Uriah, and he says to him, go home. V'yomer David la'Uriah, raid la'beischa, go down to your house. By Yishkav Uriah Pesach Beis HaMelech. Uriah staged a protest. He said, I am not going home. I'm going to sleep right here. And he says, Eskol Avdei Adonav, and all his master's servants. He took with him a whole contingent of people that were loyal to his master. Who is his master? Yoav. It was told to David, Uriah didn't go home. He didn't listen to you. David calls me. He says, what's going on? Why didn't you go home? And here's what he says. He says, Ha'aron, the Aron itself, and all of Israel, the Yehuda, and all of Shevet Judah, your own nation, your own tribe. Yoshvim v'sukos, they're all living in tents and huts. V'adoni Yoav, and my master Yoav, and all of V'avdei Adoni, and all of his loyalists, they're camping on the field. V'ani avo el basi, and I'm going to stay home like you are. In other words, this was a protest. This was a coup brewing, which was not uncommon between the chief of staff and the king. He was a Moreid B'Malchus, and it wasn't the first time. This is who he was, which is why it seems that between Bathsheba and Yoav already was a lot of dissension. Okay? Now, David had a right, the halacha is, to kill a Moreid B'Malchus. But here's where one lie leads to the next. How do you kill a Moreid B'Malchus? Someone who rebels against the king. What's the legal channels? You take him to Beis Din. You let him be tried. You let him have his day in court, defend himself. And if they consider him Chayav Misa, he has the dignity of being killed for his crime and by Beis Din. And when Beis Din kills a person, they're Mechaper. It atones for the person. Okay? And David himself, and this is what we talked about, between what you know to be true and how you let yourself act, that gap is the sin. David is described as Admoni, red. In other words, he had a nature that was red-blooded, like an Esav, you might say. That's why he was a warrior, and this whole thing with Bathsheba was part of that. But it calls him Admoni, what are the next words? Im Yefei Einayim. And they're not talking about his eyes physically. It says Im Yefei Einayim that he submitted to the Einei Ha'eda, the Sanhedrin. On every count, he listened to Sanhedrin. He did what was right, what was legally the right thing to do, the emes. But here, he didn't want to bring Uriah to the Sanhedrin because why? It'll all come out. Why'd you call Uriah home from the battle randomly and tell him to sleep with his wife? What is going on? The whole story will come out. So now one thing leads to the next. So he takes Uriah, who was guilty, okay, and he sends him back to the battlefront with a letter to Yoav to put him on the front lines. They were besieging a city, and everybody knows that the front lines, you don't come close to a city with a wall because they're on top of the wall throwing rocks and hot oil down on you. So you strategize in a smarter way, right? So he says, put Uriah in the front lines. Yoav goes ahead. One bad thing leads to the next. And he mounts an attack on the city and on the walls. So not only does Uriah die in this crazy strategy, other people die, which wasn't David's fault, but that's what happens when one bad thing leads to the next. Now, it's because Yoav did that. And then news came to David, and he was upset. Why would you do a front, you know, straight attack on a walled city? What were you doing? He says, well, many people died, among them Uriah. So the whole thing becomes worse and worse. Now, how do you get to this point where your one lie needs another lie to protect it, etc., etc.? When Nasan HaNavi came to him, he said, you know what your sin was? And it wasn't Gilui Arayos, and it wasn't Shfichas Damim because he was Chayav Misa. You had no pity, just like that man had no pity. On who? On Uriah. When? When did you have no pity on Uriah? When you didn't let him die by Sanhedrin, and you let him die a disgraceful death, killed in war by Bnei Amon. That's what he said. He said, then that's what Nasan HaNavi says to him. He said that was a infringement on his rights. He had a right to be taken to Beis Din. And he says, Baharagta oso haragta becherev b'nei Amon. You killed him by B'nai Ammon. That's your biggest sin. That's not how we normally see it. He had no compassion on Uriah. Now, by the way, just for a frame of reference, okay, compare this to how kings conducted themselves 3,000 years ago. Gilei Arayos, they took anyone they wanted. Shfichas Damen, they killed anyone they wanted. It still goes on today. There's no courts and there's no trials in most part of the world. There's a bullet in the head in the middle of the night. That's what justice is. Okay? He's angry at David that David allowed himself to enter into such a world where so much damage took place, all because it started with a temptation. Somebody, there was a temptation that came and may settled in, which caused himself to rationalize many, many things. He brought Uriah home, which caused Uriah to really, kind of like protest. Maybe Uriah would have been quiet about it had he not brought him home and told him to do this. He wouldn't have had a stage of protest. Right? So one bad thing leads to the next. And that's what Nasan Navi is telling all about, because of compassion on yourself, giving in to your own temptation creates lies and more lies and a web of lies. Now, as soon as Nasan HaNavi pointed this out to David, what did he do? He said, Ata ha'ish, you're the man. He says, Chatas el Hashem, I've sinned. He called the lie the lie. He didn't defend himself. He could have defended, each stage of the way somehow, but he stopped making excuses. He stopped making all excuses and he says, Chatas, I've sinned. I've sinned. And there starts his tshuva. He descends. Finally, truth begins to emerge. And all the sheker falls apart on its own. And now the whole world knows what happened. David tried so hard to not let it be known. And the end is everybody now knows. But yet, knowing this, that in David's own life, he himself got into a situation where the MS was invisible. It was so covered up with so many layers. And yet there came a point where he was asked to pull away the veil and call sheker sheker. He did it, and that's when truth starts to grow, and David becomes the paradigm of facing the sheker, calling it sheker, and starting to rebuild himself from the bottom up, which is, by the way, exactly what who did? Yehuda with the story of Tamar. This is the element of Malchus is Hoda'ah. David is from Yehuda, submission to the truth, correct? Accepting, acknowledging the emes. And what by acknowledging the emes, what you're doing is you're eliminating the sheker. Stop defending the sheker. So now, if we say that Hashem says to Klal Yisrael, Ek Asher Eket, 21 times 21, that means that in the end, after a whole journey through history, what will happen is truth will blossom through the grandchild of David HaMelech, as Tzemach David. Truth will emerge in all of its nuances, and in every corner of the world, it's a multiplication, it's an expansion of the truth, and yet the whole world, every lie has to play itself out in order for it to be seen for what it is, so we don't get disheartened and we don't get hopeless by all the sheker that swirls around us and screams and yells with a loud voice and declares that what we know is emes is sheker, and what sheker is called emes. We don't get disheartened. That's the process of it. And each person, though, here's the thing. Each person has to, in their own, we all have to, in our own personal life, stop calling the sheker emes. And I just want to say something. I never do this type of thing, but, there's a huge rally for Rubashkin. And everybody got up and spoke about the miscarriage of justice, okay? And it's true, and we have personal experience in our family of the justice system, and it could be as corrupt as anything else out there that's corrupt, and unjust as anything that's unjust. However, when we say unjust, we mean that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. That's what we mean. I mean, it doesn't mean that nobody sinned. Everybody sins. Everybody does the wrong thing. A lot of people make mistakes. But it's when we call injustice is the punishment that's way out of proportion to the crime. Okay? However, when we yell and scream about injustice, there are little forms of injustice and lies that that surround us all the time that we're so comfortable with. We rationalize them as pure MS. I'll mention one thing which is easy for everybody. My grandfather used to talk about this all the time. Okay, when you pay for items in a store, you are allowed to pay cash. It's legitimate currency. And it's not your job to know if that storekeeper is paying sales tax or not. However, if they openly say, give me cash and I won't charge you sales tax, okay? That means you do a lie, you lie, and I lie. We'll both do Geneva together. And we take this for granted, that that's how business is done. Everybody does it. It's Geneva. It's Geneva against the country, which is not a perfect country, but the best country that we've ever lived in. And I know one time when this first happened to me, I actually bought something in a store in this neighborhood, and it cost some money, and there was some tax on it. And she said to me, do you have a table? Do you have like a washcloth or a pillowcase? I said, I don't know what you're talking about, because you know. She says, well, I'll ship it to New Jersey, because then I'll send the washcloth to New Jersey, like as if I sent the clothes to New Jersey, because if something shipped to New Jersey, you don't pay tax. I said, you know what? There are so many exciting things in this world that you can go to hell for. It is not going to be over $50. I have much better things to go to hell for than $50, okay? I said, you know what? Don't offer it. You know, she said, well, that's how people expect it. I said, okay, just don't offer it. It's different. You know, if you find an assignment, I'm not going to buy this unless I don't pay tax. Whatever, so you cut into your profit margin, whatever. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but... If we complain about lies and dishonesty, we can't tolerate, you know, or rationalize clear Geneva and dishonesty that we're used to. It says how it is. And there's a million different examples of this, you know. And what I feel is lacking in all of these big outcries and gatherings about the injustice, and we should, you know, what should we do? We should support the fund that's trying to get him an appeal, and we should say it to Hillen. But what needs to be mentioned is we should be more honest ourselves, and somehow it never gets mentioned. But we all know why. But that's a separate issue. But when MS has to start with the person saying, I want, let's devote ourselves to MS on every single level. What comes out of our mouth? Fight money. How much money are you going to lose by paying tax at the end of the year? A few thousand dollars, $10,000, whatever it is, so that you're not losing it. It's Kiddush Hashem. My grandfather was so machpanin when he would get a little extra money from a non-Jewish shopkeeper, and he would say that he told my father once, I'm going to go back, I'm going to stick my yarmulke and my beard in his face and say, here, you gave me extra money. I want him to see that Jews are honest. And he utterly despised. Dishonesty in the name of Torah, which, you know, is despicable, and all kinds of situations that lead inevitably to dishonesty, because when people are poor and people don't have a parnassa, people don't have an education so that they can have a parnassa, they resort to shtick, all kinds of shtick to try to make the money. And he used to say, if you don't have a legitimate profession and make a parnassa legitimately, you only have two options. He would say, schnorr and schwindel. And he said they're both not honorable professions. Schwindel is swindling. So when we talk about MS in all the little things in everybody's life, we need part of it. Okay, now we can take a few questions if anybody has questions. Yes. Very, very good. Very, very good. Excellent. Excellent. And she said that Dafka Amon is the nation that is guilty of not having compassion on Klal Yisrael. Exactly. And he was killed by Amon because David didn't have compassion.
Sir, you should mention who your grandfather is. Two people just asked.
Rav Shimon Schwab, I'm sorry. My grandfather's Rav Shimon Schwab.
You were there for the most important part yesterday. And if what you should, you weren't there.